Okay, I wanted to start by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to present this work. And actually, one of the organizers, Pedro, is a collaborator. So, I'm going to talk about the S-matrix bootstrap for the two-dimensional ON model. So some things we learn from there is a two-dimensional model, but still we learn a lot of interesting things. And at the end, I'm going to describe first, I'm going to argue that this is related to convex maximization, and there is something called the dual convex maximization that will allow us to do some interesting things. I'm going to describe that at the end, and that's part of a new work we are doing with Lucia, Ifei, He, and Pedro. This is in preparation, so it's not published. And the previous work on the ON model is based on work I've done with Ifei also and Andy Irgan at Purdue University, and Ifei now is at SACLE. And then at the same time, two other works appear related to the same problem by Pedro and Lucia, by Paulus and Zhang. Okay, so last week, Andrea Guerrieri gave, talk about this S-matrix bootstrap, but just in case, I'm gonna start describing briefly what the S-matrix bootstrap is. So the title will be I'm going to then discuss a brief example of the Sine-Gordon model, briefly the example of the Sine-Gordon model, and then I'm going to discuss the ON model and then this dual convex maximization. So what is the S-matrix bootstrap? Well, in the 70s, or 50s actually, 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was a very interesting time for particle physics. The strong interactions were very mysterious. And many interesting ideas appeared in those days, like Rege trajectories, Veneziano amplitude, that gave rise to string theory, as we know. And another idea, very important, was the S-matrix bootstrap, although it wasn't as fruitful as the others. And what they said, like Chu, Mandelstam, and many others, Flauschi, and they said that the S-matrix satisfies constraints from symmetry, analyticity, unitarity, and crossing. And if you understand properly all those constraints, you should be able to find a unique S-matrix that satisfies all those in some sort of self-consistent way. Now, this turned out not to be true, so there are many consistent field theories that define S-matrices, so that is not unique, but there was a recent idea in a series of papers by Paulus, Penedones, Toledo, Van Rees, and Vieira, where they argue that one should study the space of allowed S-matrices, and in that space, find some particular S-matrices, for example, by maximizing a functional, and that will give some distinguished S-matrices that may be of interest physically. And one example of a function is a coupling between the particle and its bound, states. So what did we learn from the ON model? In the ON model, there is no bound states, so we needed to think a little bit more. And the thing we were arguing is that if you look at all these constraints that I mentioned, and suppose you take a subspace, for example, the space of two particle states, in that space, the S-matrix, if you constrain it with unitarity and crossing symmetries and all that, the allowed space is convex. And convex spaces, well, there are many kinds of convex spaces, but many times they have distinguished points like vertices. And we found that the ON model is in one of those vertices of this space of allowed S-matrices. And if it's a vertex, then if you maximize the linear functional, imagine the space here is the inside of this. Suppose I draw it like this. It's not like this, obviously, but I'm just trying to do this part, so the inside of this like kind of curved tetrahedron is a space of allowed S-matrices that has a vertex. Maximizing a linear functional, for example, is finding the highest point. And the highest point will usually be a vertex. If I tilt this, for example, I tilt it, the highest point is still a vertex, unless I go like this. But okay, since this is curved, there will be a range of normals or directions in which I find maxima at all these points, and then I will go to another vertex and so on. And so the distinguished feature of the ON model is in a distinguished point in a vertex of the space of S-matrices rather than it maximizes a function. So if it's such a point, will always maximize some function. In that way, you can also find, for example, the free theory. Elossi and Pedro found another theory that is also integrable, has zero transmission, and it's not exactly at the vertex, so there is a, it's an edge with some, well, I'm going to discuss it later, but it's also in some particular point of this space. Now, this space is infinite dimensional, so how do we get, this is just three dimensions, so how can we get a better idea of what this space looks like? And so I'm going to describe this more in detail later, but I wanted to show you some results first. So in the ON model, it's a two-dimensional model, so there is only one Mandelstam variable, the S. The T is just related to S, and U is zero. So we can evaluate the S matrices, which are functions of one variable, as a function of S, and analytically continue in the complex plane. And in this case, there are three S matrices, the reflection, the transmission, and the annihilation. They are all functions of S. And I'm going to take this model has particles, all particles of the same mass, m squared, and I'm going to set it to 1. So the two-particle threshold is at S equals to 4. So I'm going to consider the point S equals to 3, for example. And that's an unphysical point, so you need analytic continuation. And the question we're going to ask is if you have the value of the reflection, transmission, and annihilation, what are the allowed values of these quantities at this point in energies? Well, again, it's not energy, it's analytically continued, but the Mandelstam variable. Yeah, yeah, this is a summary only. So I want to show first so that people get interested and hopefully will listen the rest. So, but they are just particles here. Transmission goes through, reflection come back, and annihilation, they annihilate. But that's, we are going to write it formally later. And then, well, here you get a space of allowed S matrices, and actually Lucia and Pedro made a 3D print of this space. So if I can show it here, is will take some time. Okay, I think that's good, that's good. So for example, there is this vertex here, this is the free theory. Then if you look here, there is another point here, which I think is the ON model. Then there is another point here, which is hard to see, there are two edges touching here, which is this point that Lucia and Pedro found. And then there is symmetry S minus S. So you have another free theory here. You have another ON model there and so on. So you have this, you see these faces and all that. So it's really nice. And you can look at it if you want. Okay, I return it to Lucia who printed it. But okay, so we indeed we see that I like this. This is part of this preparation and preparation. I like that because you actually, this was kind of an idea in an infinite dimensional space, but you can actually see it now. And these vertices are, one can say, similar to what happens in the usual, now we can consider usual conformal bootstrap, but these vertices are not a product of the method, they are just in the actual space of S matrices, you find those vertices. Now, I can show you also the computer, so you can show it in the computer, the plot, the three-dimensional plot. Great, so that's there. So this is the shape, and those yellow points is the free theory. The purple is the ON model. The blue is we call it the Lucia-Pedro model, the Nguyen-Baxter model, and then that green is a constant solution, which is also interesting. But for example, analytically, using this dual method that I mentioned, there is a kind of box around. You can very easily find those bounds, which are obviously not perfect bounds because the bound, numerical bound, is this shape. but we could find those exterior bounds. And I can, so this is for fun, but it's also nice, it's nicer to actually, well, no, I don't know if it's nicer, but it's easier to look at another point, which is S equals to 2. This is the crossing symmetric point because T is 4 minus S. And at this point, the annihilation and the reflection are the same. So you can plot the allowed values of transmission and reflection. And those are the allowed values. So the blue curve gives the numerically allowed values. So inside the blue curve, those are all allowed values. And what one, and the corner here on the right is the for one, transmission equals to 1 is the free theory. And the, some point there which touches the line is a constant solution. The intersection vertical there is the new Jahn-Bachter model. And there is a kink that is hard to see in this picture. You have to really zoom, which gives you the ON model. But there doesn't seem to be a kink in this picture in the new Jahn-Bachter model. So it's not obvious that all models correspond to vertices in all directions. But in this 3D picture, that point is also distinguished. OK, so what are the other curves? So with this other method, what we found is there is this polygon outside. It's easy to find those bounds analytically. So we know that this blue curve is inside that right away. And then there is a rectangle inside. So one can immediately, I mean, with almost no calculation, show that the blue curve has to be between those two. In particular, that means that the blue curve has to have a kink at the free theory because there is no way to go from one wedge to the other without a kink. So it's not that this kind of very sharp is really a kink. And then we have a way to find, let's say, the red curve. So we can bracket the blue curve between the two red curves and the two green and converge towards that. So we know at each step how to bracket and get closer to the blue curve. We can compute the blue curve directly, but it's also nice that we can bracket it in that way. OK, so those are mainly the results. So that's, we are done with the pictures. And thank you. So so again, let me repeat that the linear functional is generically maximized at the vertex. And this, but there are many functions that, so many like planes that go like this, that the last point they touch is the vertex. That's the main property of these systems. Then I'm going to discuss this dual convex problem. And in certain cases, this allows us to show that, for example, a certain point is indeed a maximum of a functional to prove it analytically. It can allow us to prove that there is a cusp. For example, there is a, sorry, a kink in the curve, like we saw in the free theory. And also allows us to show that unitarity in general is always saturated for all energies when you maximize these functionals. OK, so let me now start the talk, basically. This was the summary. Okay, so first, what do I mean by the space being convex? That's very simple. Suppose I have a S matrix and I have a subspace, D here, which in general I want to consider, not in general, I usually consider the two particle states. Then we have the S matrix continuous like this. If I multiply by the dagger, I have to get the identity, that's unitarity. So if I look inside the subspace D, what I get is SD dagger is equal to 1. And that means that if I do SD dagger and I subtract 1, this is a minus S1 S1 dagger, which is definite, semi-definite negative. So you get this constraint on SD from unitarity. And this can be seen as equivalent to writing this and require that this is positive semi-definite. And the space of positive semi-definite matrix is convex. This is not a motional semi-definite matrix, but you have some linear constraint, which is these are one and these are dagger of each other. You also have linear constraint of crossing, global symmetries, and analyticity. But a convex space plus linear constraints is still convex. So that's what we mean by the space being convex. That's all. So let me give briefly the example of the Sine-Gordon model. So this is an example that started the, well, I don't know if it started, but one of the first that was obtained in this matrix approach by Paulos, Penedones, Toledo, Van Rees, and Vieira. So I'm going to be brief. So in this case, you have two particle scattering of two particles with mass m that represents these elementary excitations of the Sine-Gordon model, the field phi. And then they scatter in two dimensions. The energy is energy and momentum conservation imply that these are the same and these are the same, so they don't have any way to deflect. And the S is P1 plus P2 squared, so it's 4E squared. And S and T are related, as I said. So the crossing is this. If I put, well. And this theory, we assume, has a bound state, because, well, the Sine-Gordon has a bound state, has many, but we only consider one. And this bound state we parameterize with some parameter gamma here. This is just conventional from the Sine-Gordon model. So this matrix is required to have two particle cuts, and it's required to have poles at the value of the bound state. This has smaller energy, so it's a bound state than 2m. And it has a T-channel cut and a T-channel pole. So, and this pole has some residue, which gives you the coupling between these particles and its bound state, and the point is to maximize the residue. And the method, well, there were different papers, but at the end, the simplest way to do it is to go from the S-plane. So in the S-plane, you have a cut here at 4, cut here, and you have the two poles. So you go to the rapidity plane that is related S4m squared cos squared of theta over 2. This gives you the physical strip between 0 and I pi corresponding to the S-plane. And then you can do go to the z-coordinate of the this space, which is where the physical space is just a circle. And the upper half here is the physical line where the real energies actually are. And you have two poles. And in this z-plane, you can write the S-matrix as a, and again, I'm being brief. So this is being studied a lot. But I want to just say what's happening. So there is a pole and a T-channel pole. Crossing symmetry here is z to minus z. And the A is related to the value of M2. And there is a residue, which is related to the original residue we wanted to maximize. By unitarity, the modulus of S at the boundary of the disk is less or equal than 1. So the problem reduces to maximizing g under this condition. So this is for the whole thing, and with the condition that this function is analytic inside the unit disk. So we need to find the function, the analytic function that preserves this and makes g the largest. The trick to do this is to introduce something called a CDD factor, which cancels. It creates two poles, but outside the disk, so it doesn't matter. It cancels these two poles and has a property that is crossing symmetric, z to minus z, and has modulus 1 at the boundary at e to z e to the I phi. So if I multiply the S matrix by this F, I will get a function that is completely analytic inside the unit disk, and the residue here will be related to the value of S1 at the point where we used to have a pole. So the idea is to maximize this value on analytic function that has modulus 1 at the boundary. And this is this principle of the maximum, and that gives you that the S matrix has to be 1, the maximum is 1, this S matrix that maximizes that is 1, and then the original matrix S of Z is 1 over F, and 1 over F is a well-known matrix computed by Korepin, I think, Samolochikov, and in the original papers on this Sine-Gordon. And that's how they derive the Sine-Gordon model. And I want to make some comments here in regard to what I said at the beginning. So first, when you get here, if you maximize the value of this function at some point on the imaginary axis, you get that the function that maximizes that is 1, and the value then is 1. But you could maximize the same the function, the value of the function at any other point. And that means, and you will also get 1. And that means that there is an infinite number of functionals that maximize the, that can be maximized, and that also will give the Sine-Gordon model. And that's this vertex property that we were mentioning. To make it more explicitly, suppose you have this S matrix that you found in this way, and you want to make a variation that preserves unitarity, crossing and all the properties. So suppose I have this function S1, and now it turns out to be 1, but I add something infinitesimal fluctuation to explore the space of allowed S matrices around the Sine-Gordon model, which is given by 1. Again, the Sine-Gordon model is 1 over F because this is a Sine-Gordon, but I'm looking at this function. So Xi, for example, has to be crossing symmetric, and so on, but the main point is that the modulus of S1 has to be less or equal than 1 at the boundary. And if I do that, this, then I get 1 plus Xi conjugate, plus this. But at first order, if I want to explore the neighborhood, I get that real part of Xi has to be negative. And that means that the allowed fluctuations are real part negative, which if I have parameterized my fluctuations precisely by the real part of Xi, is the negative quadrant. So it's exactly a convex space with a vertex. The vertex is at Xi equals to 0, and that's where the Sine-Gordon model is, when there is no fluctuation. This is like a cube, but it's infinite dimension. Now you can say, well, but you also have the imaginary part, so you are forgetting that, but that's not true because its Xi is analytic, so knowing the real part at the boundary is already give you the imaginary part. So the real part is the only parameter that you need, and in this space of parameters, you see that the space of allowed S matrices looks like a vertex, where at the tip you have the Sine-Gordon model. The other thing I want to say is, how do you have this principle of the maximum? Let me do a very simple computation, which is the same as gonna do that, to show that this is indeed the case. So suppose I have a disk. Suppose I have a disk like there, and I want to maximize the real part of the value of a certain analytic function at 0, with the condition that the modulus at the boundary is less or equal than 1. Then one simple way to do this is to say that this is the real part, the integral around the boundary of this. This has a pole at 0, this is analytic, so it doesn't matter. So this gives, and I'm taking the real part, so it's that. And I put z equals to e to the I phi, so this cancels, I get an I that cancels this, so I get just 1 over 2 pi integral between 0 and 2 pi of a real part of s d phi. phi is the angle around the boundary, and this is less or equal than the integral of the modulus of S around the boundary, but the modulus of S is less or equal than 1. So this is less or equal than 1, because if this is 1, I get 2 pi. So I immediately see that the maximum value that I can have for the real part of this function at the center is 1. And when do I saturate that? To saturate that, I need the modulus of S to be 1 everywhere. So I need to saturate any unitarity everywhere. If not, I will never get 1. Then I need the real part to be equal to the modulus. So I need the imaginary part everywhere to be 0, and the real part to be positive. And that means that S has to be 1. That's the only solution. So S is 1 all around here, and then by analytic continuation, S is equal to 1 inside. And this is the same method we want to use for the ON model. So this is a very simplified version, but it shows you that first you always saturate unitarity when you maximize, and then you get this, the value of this matrix from this argument. Yes. No, you can move around. We live at the edge of the space, but there doesn't have to be a corner. It could be a smooth point. That's what I was showing in the picture. There are some smooth lines that saturate unitarity, and then suddenly there is a kink.
So couldn't, I mean, if it satisfies unitarity, I could redefine an S1 by dividing by it, and then this S1 would be equal to 1 at the boundary, and then I could run this argument. What am I missing?
Well, but this is a single one, but suppose you have three S matrices like transmission, reflection, annihilation, and all that. We found, no, there is not, you have points at the boundary that, let's say, are like this, and then is not a kink, and they saturate. So you have several S matrices here that saturate unitarity. So you can make the formations of the S matrix. So preserving unitarity, the question is if you can do the deformation with plus and minus and always saturate unitarity. Here you cannot do that because, well, there is only one, and then you have to do the real part is negative, so it cannot be negative and positive at the same time. But in general, you can do that. Yeah, I don't see
why. So perhaps I think I understood my confusion. So once you know the poles and you want unitary to be exactly saturated, then,
no, for this
then
case,
the S matrix is unique, right? If you don't put any more zeros.
I mean, for this case, I just showed it. But so you have to consider some other case. This case, yes, but that's what I said. So in other cases, it's not like this.
But let's say I asked a general question. So in the space of S matrices with this analytic structure, what are the vertices? Is your statement that it's only...
Yes, that S is equal to 1.
Those would be for...
Well, the 1, I mean, with the F. So. Yes, that's the statement in this case.
Okay, I think it's better to discuss afterwards.
But yeah, now let's consider the ON model, which is richer, and then there is more than one function, and then you have a bit more structure. And there you can see So the ON model is the ON nonlinear sigma model. So the Lagrangian, you can start from this Lagrangian. This is in Minkowski, but so these are XT. And this was studied in the 70s by Polyakov initially, and this he showed that this is asymptotically free, and it was studied as a toy model of QCD. Was shown by Samolochikov and Samolochikov that in the low energy this develops a mass gap, and one can compute the S matrix exactly, and the symmetry is restored, so it's O-N symmetric, the vacuum is O-N symmetric, and there is N particles, N species of particles or bosons with mass M. And now the S matrix is the same as similar as before, but now you have an index that goes from 1 to N. And the S matrix, now formally, you can write it like this. So if A becomes, let's put C here. I want to keep the notation. So if A becomes C and B is D, that's called the transmission. So this is delta AC, delta BD, some function of center of mass energy. And then if A is D and B is C, that's the reflection. And then if A is B, so these two are like particle 1 and 1, they can annihilate and create particle 1, 1, or 2, 2, or any of the others. And this is the annihilation. And now this is multiplied by a delta function, as we know, because of what we said before, P1 minus P3, P2 minus P4. And then you have these are bosons. You have this interchain of final states. So this defines the S matrix, and the S matrix is given in terms of these three functions, which are the same three functions I was mentioning before. Now, crossing symmetry here tells you that if you look at you interchange 1 and 3, for example, the transmission goes to itself, and the reflection becomes annihilation. You do that. So these are the crossing symmetry conditions. And unitarity, for unitarity, you have to go to the fixed isospin channel because then isospin will be conserved. And the final state has to have the same isospin. So you conclude that the modulus of the probability, the probability has to be less or equal than 1, so the modulus that has to be less or equal than 1. The isoscalar channel turns out to be this. The symmetric and anti-symmetric representations are given by this, and what you have is the SI, or S real and bigger than 4. Oh, now I'm putting M equals to 1. It has to be less or equal than 1. And the same in the same region for physical energies is this. So this is the problem we have. It doesn't have any poles or bound states. We have this S matrix given by these three functions. These three functions have to obey with this linear combination that the modulus of this is less or equal than 1 on the real axis and on the physical values of energy, and here they have again two cuts, but there are no poles. So I usually gonna use the rapidity, so there won't be any poles, and the physical axis becomes the real line. So we have these conditions less or equal than one only are valid down here. They are not valid up here because when you do crossing, these have a more complicated crossing that comes just from here. And it doesn't imply that the modulus is 1 up here. And under those conditions, we evaluate the three functions, for example, at this point, and one asks what's the maximum value or what's the space of allowed values. And in that way, we got that shape that I showed before. If you evaluate here, which is corresponds to S equals to 2, because of the crossing, these two are the same there. And so you only have two S functions that you want to evaluate there, and that gives the other plot. So I'm not going to show, for the sake of time, I'm not going to show the plots again because I already discussed them, but I'm going to go into this other convex, dual convex problem that allowed us to get some interesting conclusions from here. But I hope, okay, I want to make sure the problem we are trying to solve and that we solve numerically, and I already show the result, is the following. So ignore now the ON model. We have a theory with n bosons of mass m. The S matrix is described by three functions of center of mass energy. These three functions obey these crossing relations. They have cuts from 4 to infinity and from minus infinity to 0. And this linear combination have modulus less or equal than 1 on this cut, but not on that one, or not necessarily on that. And under those conditions for the most generic analytic functions, we want to know the space of allowed values, and that we can characterize by evaluating at different points and plotting the space of allowed values. If we plot the space of allowed values here, we get a two-dimensional shape. And if you plot it here, we get a three-dimensional shape. In principle, you could think of an infinite-dimensional space. That will be a good way to think about this. But in these other ones are much simpler, so we are doing that now. Okay, so we solved that problem numerically, and we found the result that I already discussed. So that's kind of solved, and in those results in particular, show that the free theory, for example, and the ON theory are at the vertex of those shapes, at vertices of those shapes. So, okay, that's the first part. Now, I want to discuss this other dual problem that allowed us to do some analytic computations on this shape and get some.
But can you say, like, okay, how do you solve this problem numerically? Because there was the original method in the first papers. Is there some progress on how you're supposed to approach this?
Again, sorry?
I was wondering, is there anything new about how you're supposed to solve this kind of problems numerically? Because I'm only aware of the original method where you would kind of discretize with splines or something like that, and then.
Well, one thing we have is this bracket, that we can bracket the solution between those two curves. And for that, I'm going to.
Bracket is the analytic stuff. I mean, you are. But how about the numerically? How do you solve this numerically, this problem? Are you going to discuss this?
We did it the same as in the original paper. Okay. The only new thing is we put periodic functions along the theta axis and then change the period. That gives a more precise numerical results, but Moulvinol is similar method. So the new thing is this other analytic, but that gives a different numeric. Well, okay, maybe some different numerics, but it's still discretizing. Sorry, no, there is no. So okay, so we have this problem. I'm gonna call these functions SA of theta. A will be the given isospin representation, so they are the ones that modulus of this has to be less or equal than 1 on the real axis. And the functional we want to maximize is, for example, I'm going to consider here the symmetric case where we get this two-dimensional curve. So Na is three numbers that I choose arbitrary in principle, but I will scan the different ends, and that will give me different functionals, and I will find the maximum of these functionals, and that will allow me to plot those shapes. But, okay, I'm not going to do that, so what I want to do is some simple calculation, which is as follows. Like before, like I discussed in the Stein-Gordon, but now more generically, I'm going to take three analytic functions, k of theta, that have poles at I pi over 2, in this case, where I evaluate the function. And the residue of the pole, I'm going to require it to be this Na. And so this will be and the contour is going along the real line like this, and then coming back above. But coming back above, I can do by crossing, because I know that this is some matrix times SB at theta, so at the, on the real axis. But I don't know, well, this K is arbitrary, so I can impose something. So I'm going to impose that this K obeys this. So it's anti-crossing, I guess, with a minus and with the transpose of C. And the reason is that if I do this with the C, and I do this with the transpose, C, the crossing matrix, squares to 1, and it cancels, and the minus sign compensates for the two directions. You are going like this, you're going like that. So in the end, you get that this is just, this is always sum over A. Here it's convenient to write this explicitly. So under those conditions, we get that we can evaluate this as an integral purely on the real axis. So I need to integrate S on the real axis, and this function that obeys anti-crossing have a pole with this residue and otherwise arbitrary. For any function k, I will get this is equal to the functional. But now I want to do the same as we did before, so we're going to say, because of the I can write this simply. So I want to say that the imaginary part is less or equal than the modulus of this function. And the modulus of S, because I'm on the real axis, is less or equal than 1. And so I conclude that if I have any function, analytic function, with this pose here, and this crossing symmetric point, and I integrate that function between minus and plus infinity, so I would like some functions that the integral is finite. If it's infinite, okay, it will be trivial bound. Then I integrate the modulus and I sum. This number is always larger than the f that I can find. So the f can never be bigger than this. And that's a kind of elementary statement from what I said, but it allows us to say many different things. One is these external curves that I was showing. So if you put some trial functions k, you immediately find an upper bracket for the bound. So you know that you cannot go above that. For example, a simple function that one can take is this, INA over cos theta. It has a pole at I pi over 2. And if you integrate, this is always positive. So you just integrate 1 over cos, which is pi. So you get that this bound is sum over A modulus of NA. So the F can never be bigger than this. And that's how we plot this external polygon and also this external box in the 3D case. And I'm going to...
Is it obvious that obeys?
Yes, sorry. Okay, so then this NA has to be equal... So NA has to obey that. Because the cos of I pi minus theta is minus cos, so very good. So... NA has to be with this, and then it cannot be bigger than that. So that's when I evaluate at I pi over 2, that restricts the direction to two dimensions. Okay, so first we can get this external curve that go down. The internal curve is simply by saying that if I have S and I restrict to a subset of S's, in this case, for example, to the to periodic functions, then the maximum that you can get will not be the actual maximum, but will be smaller. So that gives a lower bracket for the maximum. And if you put some k, which is not the imaginary k, for example, this one, you get an upper bracket for the maximum. So you have immediately, you have bracketed what's the maximum value. The other thing you can do is you can prove that a certain functional maximizes the bound. For example, if I have some fixed NAs and I have somebody give me a functional, if this, I evaluate this number, if I find some case such that evaluating this number, I get the same number, then I know that the functional, that this function maximizes the functional, because the value of the functional can never be bigger than that, and if it attains that value for certain k, then I prove analytically that this certain functional is a maximum of the functional. For example, the free theory has all s is equal to 1. So for the free theory, this f is just a sum over a and a, which is indeed less or equal than the modulus. But so when will the free theory be a maximum of this functional? Well, it's obvious when all the nas are positive. So if I choose all the nas positive here, I will get a functional that is maximized by the free theory, because this will be equal to that. And moreover, I get a bunch of functionals, because there are many n's that are positive, obviously, and only that I have to still satisfy this constraint, but still there is a bunch. And in that way, we can show that, for example, this normal, all these normals are, this is a two-dimensional shape. This is a free theory, that if I go like this, the last point I find is a free theory, but if I go like this, up to certain angle that we can compute later, if we have time, that will be the maximum will be the free theory. So the free theory is indeed at the kink of this shape, because there are many functionals that are maximized there, and that's the proof. And finally, there is a theorem from convex maximization that says that if the original space of where you are maximizing is convex, as is this case, then the so-called duality gap, which is the difference between the maximum of this and the minimum of this, so the minimum, so the, you can say, okay, the best bound I can get is by minimizing this functional over the space of k's that obey this and this. And the theorem says that the minimum of this functional over that space of k's is equal to the maximum of these functionals of the space of original space, which in this case is the space of analytic functions with modulus less or equal than 1. This is done for a discrete case, and for some continuous cases, this particular derivation we haven't found anywhere, so haven't found anywhere, but maybe it's done, but it's a very simple way to derive those ideas. But we, okay, the proof is, should be done, I guess, in the same way as for the other case. I don't know how to. But do the proof. But suppose, okay, so we believe the proof, so we believe that this is equal to that. So that for certain s that maximizes this, and for certain k that minimizes this, the inequalities become equal. So can, how can this be equal? So this is positive, and so the integrals are equal. The only way to be equal is this is equal to that everywhere. And that means that everywhere in the real axis, the modulus of Ka for each a and each point has to be equal, if it's saturated, to the modulus of k. Okay, this is the product of the modulus, so we have this. And so we learned that either k is zero at a given point, or the unitarity is saturated. Now, k is an analytic function, so you cannot have that is zero. I mean, zero means modulus is zero, so real and imaginary part. You cannot have that is zero in an interval without being zero everywhere. So the generic case is that the unitarity is saturated everywhere on the real axis when you maximize these functionals. The alternative is that the corresponding k is zero, and there is a case in this plot where k is zero, one of the case, I mean, you only suppose k, in this case, is k plus the symmetric representation, and that means that the corresponding s plus does not saturate unitarity. So that's one of the points in that plot that is at the boundary, but does not saturate unitarity and corresponds to the corresponding k plus identically zero. But if it's not zero, identically zero, then unitarity will always be saturated. And what else do we learn? Okay, so then this has to be equal to this, And that means that the real park has to be zero, otherwise the imaginary park can never be equal to that. So the real part of this has to be zero. And the imaginary part of this has to be positive at each point, so that is equal to the modulus. And the only way to do that, if you think a little bit, is just that SA is I K bar A over modulus of KA. So what you can do is solve this dual problem. I don't know if that's what you were referring to. I mean, this is something else we are doing. You can minimize this functional with the case that satisfies that, and then compute this matrix in this way. That's an alternative numerical method, but it's still done discretizing the points and requiring this analytic and so on. But so in terms of discretization, it doesn't improve. But it could be faster depending on how you program it. It's just a question of programming more than. Most algorithms for convex maximization solve the direct and the dual problem at the same time and try to do it in the fastest possible way. But if it doesn't do it, it's convenient to give them this problem, and it's usually solved faster. But a good minimization program will figure this out and will solve the dual problem instead. Many times you put in some minimizer and it says, solving dual problem instead. And what they are doing is they are solving this. But they are doing solving the dual of the discrete problem, which is slightly different, but it's obviously the discretization of this. Okay, so this is more or less what I wanted to say. So this method allows us to put upper bounds on the bound, so bracket the bound. It proves that if S maximizes the functional, it saturates unitarity, except in special cases. And you can use it to prove that a certain S maximizes the given functional, and that is at the cusp because of the. That it maximizes several functionals at the same time. Okay, so I have 5 minutes, but maybe I have other things, but maybe I can answer questions first. Yes.
So if you make some kind of row series ansatz for these KAs,
yes,
right, and you run the numerics, do you get that numerically your bounds saturates
yes. So I'll show you that's the if we can show the picture again or yes, so this is done in the following way. So we put Ka equals to INA over cos theta, and analytically you can find the straight lines, this polygon, and that goes from like 1/2. Here is 1/n, depends on n, and then like this. But then we put another k, which is ka of theta, and we require this ka, well, at I pi over 2 to be na, so that the ratio of the pole is the same. But then we set Ka of theta is Ka of theta plus some constant. So that is periodic along the real axis. And if the period is zero, then it's just constant. But if not, you have this. And by increasing the period, you approximate general analytic functions better and better. And that's the red curve is period 2, I think. The green curve is period 3. And we get to period 8. I think there is another curve there, but it's hard to distinguish from the blue curve. That's why the blue curve looks a little bit thick. So you can converge in that way to the curve. And from the inside, what we did is we just take S matrices, which are periodic. And if you take an S matrix that is constant, zero period, you get that rectangle in the middle. So that's, you know, that has to be inside because it's not the most generic analytic function. And then you have period 2, period 3, and again period 8 basically give you the blue curve. So you have a set of curves from the inside and a set of curves from the outside that you know the boundary is always between those two. But you could choose another another function that you like, and maybe with a nice guess you get a very good upper bound on the actual curve.
Yeah. So in this case, all NAs are eigenvalues of the.
Yes, in the 3D plot they are not. Yeah.
But
so.
2D they are.
Yeah, because this is so essentially this is S transmission and this is and that's reflection. So these NAs actually have two components only. So they are vectors in this space. But here I'm writing the components in I plus and minus, so they have three components, but only two are independent because you are choosing a direction in this plane or a normal. A normal in this plane, you can always also choose a direction. For example, I can say I want real part of SA to be some alpha times some unit vector fixed, and I want to maximize alpha. And that is just choosing a direction in this space and finding the last point which will intersect the curve. And we can do this dual problem also for this. I mean, I was going, that was the next thing I could explain, but it will take some time and it doesn't add to anything. So what you have to do is just maximize the same functional with the condition that this unit vector times n is 1. So, for example, you can maximize this, or minimize, sorry, minimize. And that gives the polygon there and so on. But, yeah, so in, so if you do the 3D shape, then the, you have three components. And here you have only two in this plane.
Do you think you can generalize this to higher dimensions?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we are. We did that, but I mean, we didn't have any interesting results, I think. But, yeah, you can do it. I mean, you can put bounds in higher dimensions.
Sorry, I didn't. You said you did it, but I mean, then it works, but it's.
Well, no, we didn't have any interesting results. I mean, it's complicated to, as you know, higher dimensions, numerical is more complicated, so you have to make some answers for the K, if you want, and those, I mean, evaluating those integrals is complicated. So we don't have anything interesting. Well, it depends. So I know that this works in higher dimension, but it, I wouldn't make it work in a practical way, let's say. But I assume it's possible. Yes. Okay, I think it's done. Ah, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.